Shrink Wrap Radio number 379, The Great Colorado Cannabis Experiment, with Jerry Trumbull.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I will be speaking with my longtime friend and past guest, Jerry Trumbull, about the psychological and political consequences of the legalization of marijuana in Colorado. This is Jerry's 21st appearance on Shrink Wrap Radio. Gerald Jerry Trumbull, B.S., University of Maryland, 1965, M.S., University of Pennsylvania, 1970, has been a neuropsychological researcher at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research and NASA, University of Maryland, and assistant professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, 1970. Disgusted with academia, he moved to Denver in 1971, where he founded Sebastian High School, a gradeless experiential learning center, founded the Western States Film Institute with two winners of the Student Academy Awards, and in 1980 founded Denver's first computer training center. Now retired and living in obscurity, he says, he is a videographer and blogger of DenverDirect.tv, where he expounds on local politics and pollution, including the legalization of marijuana in that state. He continues his lifelong interest in the workings of the human brain, exploring his own brain through hypnagogia and REM sleep, and hope someday to upload the contents of his brain directly to the internet. This is Jerry's 21st appearance on Shrink Wrap Radio, and if you go to the show notes, you'll find all the episode numbers of his previous appearances here. Now, let's go to the interview. Jerry Trumbull, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hey, Dr. Dave, it's been a while, hasn't it? It's good to be back.
Yeah, it really has been a while. There was a run that we did for a while of shows that we called the Dave and Jerry Show, and we haven't done one of those in a long time. And I think I've also interviewed you on some other topics. Well, today, you live in the great state of Colorado, and Colorado is doing something that I think I'm going to refer to as the Great Colorado Cannabis Experiment. And you've been tracking that. You're kind of in the heart of it. You're personally involved in it. So take it away, Jerry.
Yes, Colorado is apparently in the forefront in regulating and licensing the sale of marijuana, cannabis, as we call it here. And of course, it has hundreds of other names, but it's an experiment done under the watchful eye of the U.S. federal government, which of course still considers marijuana to be a Schedule I drug, that is to say, no known medical purpose, which those schooled in the literature know is completely false because it's been used as a medicine for thousands of years. But that's another branch of the story altogether.
Yeah, and one of the things that I hope that we can do as we go along on this, because there's very much a political dimension, but also because this is Shrink Wrap Radio, want to also highlight the psychological dimensions wherever we can.
Yes.
And maybe one way to get into that is, I know you've made reference to a book by Michael Pollan that I never read, actually, called The Botany of Desire. I sort of think I know a little bit what it's about, but give us a little bit of The Botany of Desire and maybe how that plays into the psychological aspect.
Yes, I'd be happy to. In fact, I have it right here. And I'd first like to thank my former wife for sending me this book. I'm sure she knew that I would love what it had to say. Basically, the thesis of the entire book is that we've been looking at the plant versus animal world in the wrong way. He posits that we take a plant's eye view of the world. And in that view, animals of all kinds are being used by plants because they have mobility. Plants generally speaking, don't move around too much unless their seeds float away. But his presentation is regarding the fact that plants have evolved to take advantage of animals.
So the plants are running the show, in other words.
Yeah, yeah, that they were first and they figured out, geez, we need something with legs to run to run between and gather nuts and do all these other things that we plants will evolve to assist in that process. So for example, when you go through a patch of weeds, you often end up with thorns and things stuck to you that are hard to get off because they're sticking on there with the purpose of having you take them someplace else.
Yeah, I remember as a kid having foxtail fights.
Exactly. Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You could throw them like little darts and they would stick to your playmate's clothes. But
yeah,
go ahead. I digress.
We did the same thing with acorns. We were always having acorn battles, collecting big bags of them and throwing them. And, you know, that was dispersing the seeds for sure.
Yeah.
At any rate, it takes a while to get into the mental state of thinking like a plant. But I'm going to read a little section here starting on page 155 in the paperback edition. He says, so what are the odds that a molecule produced by a flower out in the world, by a weedy plant native to Central Asia, would turn out to hold the precise key required to unlock the neurological mechanism governing those aspects of human consciousness? There is something miraculous about such a correspondence between nature and mind, yet it must have a logical explanation. A plant does not go to the expense of making such a unique and complex molecule if it doesn't do that plant some evolutionary good. So why does cannabis produce THC? No one knows for sure, but botanists offer several competing theories, and most of them have nothing to do with getting people high, at least not at the plant's beginning. He goes on to then talk about THC protecting the cannabis plant from ultraviolet radiation and concludes that paragraph with the statement, but whatever THC's purpose, it is unlikely that, as Raphael Mushlam put it, quote, a plant would produce a compound so that a kid in San Francisco can get high, unquote. He goes on to say, or is it? Robert Clark, the marijuana botanist I met in Amsterdam, doesn't think the notion is quite as far-fetched as it's made to sound. He finds most of the defense theories inadequate and concludes that the most obvious evolutionary advantage THC conferred on cannabis was the psychoactive properties which attracted human attention and caused the plant to be spread around the world. So in that view, cannabis is evolving over time and happens to hit upon a chemical compound that, when ingested, causes humans to really like it.
Yeah. Now, let me back you up just a little bit, because somewhere in that text there was a mention of Amsterdam and that pollen was in Amsterdam. And since Amsterdam it used to be, I'm not sure if it still is, as wide open in relation to cannabis anymore, is there a story there?
He details his travels, and he was in Amsterdam specifically to check out the market and the use of marijuana there. I'm trying to look up the date of this book, copyright 2001. And of course, Colorado had not begun its march towards legalization at that time. And here locally, they're calling Denver the Amsterdam of the United States. They have various contractions that they use to put those words together. But it's clear to me, at least, that Amsterdam is pretty much over. It was never legalized there. It was allowed to be sold in the coffee shops. But I knew a guy, an American, who was over there being basically used by the industry to house sit a normal looking row house in the city that was completely devoted to growing marijuana. And they hired Americans because they were disposable.
In what way?
In the sense that if they were caught, they could be deported and that would be the end of that. Huh. Whereas a citizen of Amsterdam would be arrested and put in jail and so forth. Okay. So it was never really legalized. It was just kind of permitted. And recently they've been saying they were going to crack down on it. I don't have any current information, but I think you can probably still buy it in these same coffee shops. But once again, there's all kind of, like, if you're caught transporting it and if you have any weight, any poundage, you know, you're in deep trouble. So I think that experiment is pretty much over. What they found was that people did not exhibit, you know, the reefer madness of the propaganda films of yesteryear.
Yeah. Now, in terms of Colorado, I mean, we have a federal government that is very much opposed, as far as we know, to marijuana. Meanwhile, I think recent polls have shown that the majority of Americans would support legalization of marijuana in some sort of controlled fashion. And I believe a number of congresspeople and various intellectuals have spoken up for that point of view.
Yeah, they're saying here that pot is the new gay.
Hmm.
In the sense that gay marriage seems to have been decided in favor of the gays and allowing gay marriage. And I think something like 20 states now permit that.
Okay.
And likewise, pot seems to be moving right along to the ultimate legalization. Now, I want to define some of those terms a little later on, because it is a kind of a semantic nightmare, you know, between the total illegality and then the benign neglect that allows pot to be used without being penalized. But at any rate,
I'm kind of picturing a situation in which Colorado is kind of going wild, like the new frontier or the old frontier, and that our federal government might be poised at some point to sweep in and just smash it. Am I being paranoid?
No. California, your home state, is a good example of that very thing, where medical marijuana was approved some years ago, and then substantial businesses were built around that concept, which were then later raided. And there's one gentleman that ran a big operation. I can't remember the name of it, but they used this technique they call asset forfeiture.
Yeah.
In which they seize the property of the offending individual without a trial and without any charges being filed.
Are you saying they can seize their house and their car and not just the pot, but kind of everything?
Yeah, cars, anything associated with this person. In fact, I had a local friend, a dealer here in Denver, who a few years ago, his wife died unexpectedly, and he, without thinking, immediately drove her to the emergency room where they said, well, she's dead. And of course, he was just freaked out of his mind, went home only to be accosted by the police, who then seized his refrigerator full of pot and pills and other stuff, and then seized his house and sold it.
Wow.
And he went to jail. Fortunately, he had a very good attorney who was able to get him out, and now he's back not having anything to do with drugs. He's very strict about his new status, but it was one of those unfortunate things. But anyone who has looked into this asset forfeiture, they don't call it seizure. They call it forfeit. Like, oh, yeah, I'll forfeit my house.
Yeah, forfeiture sounds voluntary in a way, doesn't it?
Exactly. In fact, farms that have been in families for years, you know, the grand father didn't know the son was growing pot, and now the grandfather lost the entire 300 acres and so on and so forth. It's been a $1 billion source of income for the various agencies that make these raids. And that's something that to me is completely illegal, but that's one of those political considerations that have hounded this entire discussion since Anslinger. And I don't know if people have heard about Harry Anslinger, who was a federal agent under the prohibition of alcohol. And when that was repealed, he was out of a job. So he basically invented marijuana prohibition. And it was very much a racial thing back in those days because it was associated with Mexicans and with black musicians.
Yes.
And so it was kind of an easy mark to arrest those people. And it wasn't really until Nixon came along and started the war on drugs that it really ramped up, and until what we have had in recent years is the arrest of literally millions of people every year, and the stockpiling of humans in prison for victimless crimes. But I'm straying into the political aspect.
Okay, well, let me bring you back just a little bit, because when you say victimless crimes, there's going to be some proportion of our audience that are going to say, what do you mean victimless? This is all about addiction. So, you know, what's your take on psychoactive drugs and addiction?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because it's always being raised. The fear of the youth, our children, being exposed and addicted to marijuana. I come from a physiological psychology background, as you know, and to me, there's a very hard and fast definition of addiction. And it's based on the physiological effects of withdrawal. And when you shoot up with heroin, you get real high, and so I'm told. And then the next day, you want some more. And if you don't get some more, you get sick. And so, in fact, I had a good friend who had once used heroin, and he said, don't even bother trying it, because the first time you get real high, and the second time you're just trying to get well. And from then on in, you're just trying to get back to normal.
Yeah.
And I think heroin addicts adequately describe this process of needing a fix to just get back to normal. Well, from personal experience and from the literature, we don't find that kind of an effect with marijuana. As I will reveal as we go along, I've used marijuana personally for many, many years. In fact, the only time that I have ceased the use of marijuana was when I have left the country, thinking that carrying marijuana to Mexico, it's kind of a stupid idea. And
like Coles to Newcastle.
exactly.
But what you just said in many people's minds will prove that you're an addict if you've smoked it for so many years. How is that not an addiction?
Because upon withdrawal, I don't suffer any ill effects. When I have made these 2 and 3 week journeys to other countries, I don't have a craving like I got to find some pot, you know. I notice maybe a little irritability the second and third day, but nothing beyond that. Certainly nothing I would call a physiological craving.
You probably heard my interview with Gary Wilson about pornography and his premise that it does involve addiction and changes to the brain.
Yes.
Is there some kind of connection here?
Yes, I think so. There, one of the arguments often used by the anti-legalization crowd is that it will inevitably fall into the hands of the children, which are often used as a foil against the pro pot people. And that in the developing brain, the addition of psychoactive substances will impede or interfere with the normal development of the adolescent brain. I've tried to read all of those studies, and I have read some of them, and there is perhaps some evidence that, for example, in adolescent pot users followed into later life, there is a greater incidence of psychological problems. That doesn't necessarily prove that there is a cause and effect relationship there, but it's certainly worthy of further study, as they always say.
Yeah.
And so in Colorado, for example, it's prohibited to be given or sold to anyone under the age of 21. Now, I could make a similar argument that alcohol probably has equal or greater disruptive effect in the adolescent brain. But nonetheless, that's the reason why the prohibition into the sale of pot to anyone under 21 is prohibited. Now, that brings me to the medical use, and what's really in the news these days is the 7 and 8 year olds who are being, and even younger, who are being miraculously helped by being given THC, not necessarily smoking a joint, but by being given the extracted oil.
For what conditions?
Mostly brain seizures. And there's a very famous one now, given the recent reversal of our TV doctor. What's his name? Gupta. You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do.
Well, he was all.
Yeah,
he was very.
To remember his full name, but I'm not quite getting it.
Sanjay Gupta.
Oh, yeah. He's on TV quite a bit. And I think he's also written for The New Yorker, I think.
Yeah, he's quite a reliable TV medical source, at least I thought so.
Yeah, I think so.
And he was very anti-marijuana until he closely followed the case of a little girl who was, she suffered like 300 seizures a week or more.
Wow.
None of the treatment helped her until, in desperation, her parents got in touch with some local Colorado growers. And if you get a chance to watch this on the internet, you should take advantage of it because it's totally amazing. There's this group of 5 or 6 brothers growing pot up in the mountains. And along with all this clandestine pot growing that's been going on for years, has been the refinement of various strains for various purposes. For example, THC is the most well-known cannabinoid in marijuana, but there's also CBN, CBG, CBD, CBC, THCV, and THC. And apparently there are literally hundreds of cannabinoids, all of which have slightly different properties and effects. For example, you can grow a strain which is low in THC but high in CBD. And I'm looking at a little cheat sheet here. CBD is not so psychoactive. Studies have shown it to be anti-inflammatory, anti-anxiety, anti-nausea, neuroprotective, blood pressure lowering, and pain-killing properties, among many others. It turns out that this little girl, upon being given a strain, I think it's called Charlotte's Web, That's what it was named by these pot-growing brothers. And they refined it genetically over time to be low in THC and high in CBD. And it was miraculous. They gave this little girl this extract, this oil, orally, and boom. it went down to like one seizure a week.
And so you say there's a YouTube video about that?
Well, it was on broadcast TV, and I'm just guessing that if you Googled Sanjay Gupta, you could probably find part of it, or maybe the whole thing.
Probably because, Sanjay Gupta and marijuana, do a complex search. Okay.
And he did a complete 180 upon reviewing this evidence and actually talking to the parents and everything. I was really impressed with the fact that, unlike most people on TV, he was willing to change his position to the exact opposite of what he had thought before, and to go public with that. You know, I was wrong, is what he said.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very impressed with that. And I think this will probably be the last time I talk about this part. The cannabis plant in both of its form, or it has three popular forms now: indica, sativa, and hemp. The Colorado law also made hemp legal. And hemp has been known for many years as a wonderful fiber. In fact, there's actually YouTube footage of Henry Ford demonstrating his Model T with a hemp body, where he takes a sledgehammer and starts pounding on this car, and the hammer just bounces off. The hemp fiber body is so strong, it just resists the sledgehammer. And the story is, of course, that Henry Ford was swayed by the oil companies to not use that compound. And in fact, right now that hemp has been legalized in Colorado, there's already been a grow and a harvest, and others are starting to do that as well. And apparently this fibrous plant has a huge future ahead of it, because it too can be used to create plastic, but it would be biodegradable plastic. It's also used as a construction material. They call it hempcrete, and it's made into blocks, which are like concrete, except
wow.
They're
I had
lots,
no idea.
Oh, yeah. They're a lot stronger. And, of course, they're blah, 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 biodegradable. And the hemp plant itself grows to about 12, 13 feet high. It's a very skinny plant. It doesn't look like a pot plant, the classic picture of a pot plant. And it's got all these wonderful properties that make it suitable. For example, it sucks up any pollutants in the soil. There's a name for that, which I've forgotten, but it's bioprophylactic or something like that. It will actually accumulate heavy metals. Our own state legislator, Wes McKinley, last year, I think it was, got a bill passed for the experimental testing of the of that use of marijuana, or I should say hemp, to grow on the Rocky Flats plutonium toxic site here just outside of Boulder.
Wow.
I don't know if that's going forward or not, but at any rate, so hemp is one category. It has either no or extremely low THC, but as any pot grower can attest, the plant itself is very fibrous. If you split apart the limbs, the trunk and the limbs, it has fibers that you can pull out that are 6 feet long, you know, and they're very, very strong. So there's that whole possibility, which I think will really take off here in Colorado, because it doesn't take much water and it can be grown out on the eastern plains. I saw an article just yesterday where a woman had come forward with her willingness to devote 55,000 acres on the eastern plains to growing hemp. So that's one possibility. And then there's the other, cannabis sativa and cannabis indica. And these both produce a lot of THC and a lot of these other lesser-known cannabinoids. And these are what stoners like. They want to get high. Now, why humans have always wanted to get high is another question that's taken up in the botany of desire. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but we see children, for example, spinning around and around until they get so dizzy they fall over.
Sure, I did that.
Yeah, right. Rolling down hills and squealing with laughter when they can't stand up and they fall
yeah,
over.
Yeah, right. And we also developed ways to actually knock ourselves out, you know?
Yeah,
to actually, what did you call it?
The choking game.
Okay, I don't think we called it that, but we did have, you know, ways to actually pass out and fall down. So, you know, this is something that I've always been intrigued by, and have other interviews that have touched on this desire that we seem to have to get out of our heads, in a sense,
yeah,
at least for a while.
Exactly. Why we need to do that, I don't know, but we definitely need to do it.
Yeah, right. Or want to do it.
Our behavior indicates that we desire to do that. And
yeah.
I'm just leaving that whole question aside, but
and just before you leave it, you know, it's actually in so-called primitive groups, it's a technology. You know, it's a technology that shamans have used to, you know, that helps confer their status and in various ways serves their group.
Exactly.
So, and I'll be interviewing Ralph Metzger, who has written quite a bit about altered states and plant states, if you will. So we can leave some of that to him. Now, you sent me a few very fragmentary notes, and here's one that I have no idea what you're referring to. It says Rochdale College, University of Toronto, drug warehouse.
Yeah, I was trying to put down a little bit of a chronology of my own journey. And I started off with a visit from a friend from Ann Arbor who actually brought the first pot into my life. And I was delighted and smoked it and got high and invited all my friends over, and we got the munchies and all that good stuff. But when I went off in 1970 to teach at the University of Toronto, I was by that time what I would call a full-blown hippie. I had hair down to my shoulders. I always wore a black cape with various flowered shirts and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And in 1970, yeah, that was the thing. And I was completely out of place at the University of Toronto, and I only stayed there 1 year. But during that year, I heard about Rochdale College. And I said, and this was a high rise, I think 18 story building that had been given over by the university to the experimental college group. And I also heard that it was a place you could buy drugs. So I thought, well, I need to check this out. So I went down there, and indeed it was on the campus of the University of Toronto, and it was a big high rise building, and the front lobby was inhabited by bikers with shotguns. That was the first impressive thing. I mean, you knew that if you screwed up, you were going to be killed. And of course, here I was, a professor at the university, assistant professor, but nonetheless a called professor. And I was there to buy drugs. And so I told him what I wanted, and I said, oh, okay, no problem. And so the ritual was a complete search of my person. And then I was taken as an individual into the elevator and taken up to some floor. The floor buttons, the floor numbers have been removed from the buttons, so you didn't know where you were going.
That's an interesting wrinkle I've never heard before in the annals of crime.
Yeah, this was a real trip, I'll tell you. So I was led by this person down the hall to a what would have been an apartment or a suite, an office suite of some kind, unlocked the door, and then given access, led into this room that was filled to the ceiling with bricks of marijuana. A kilo is 2.2 pounds, and wrapped in plastic or paper. And this room, the aisle was maybe 2.5 feet wide. Everything else was solid pot. Wow. And I was
and
going.
And this was
like,
on the campus of the University of Toronto.
Yeah, yeah,
amazing.
Rochdale College. You can look it up and. I did on Wikipedia, and it's got a whole description and pictures and everything. So I purchased my kilo. I can't even remember how much it was, but it was probably, I'm guessing it was around $200. Anxiously took it home and smoked some of it, and it was worthless. It was.
You had been ripped off?
Yeah, it was what we called zero weed back in those days.
No.
Seemed to have no psycho properties. And I, of course, I was not going to try to sell it myself. So I eventually used it as fertilizer when I was growing other pot. I thought maybe it would have some nutrients in it that would be helpful.
I take it you didn't go back as a dissatisfied customer and confront the biker gang.
No, I did not do that. I did go back, however, to the rooftop to listen to and to record a session with Allen Ginsberg, who had been invited there. And I believe I still have that audio tape someplace. Because it was just short of miraculous. I went up to the rooftop, and I had my little tape cassette recorder, and I sat in the front on the roof, no chairs. And Ginsberg came up, and if you've ever seen him perform, you know he plays this little kind of an accordion piano thing. I don't know what it's called.
A squeeze box.
Yeah, that's a good yeah. And then he started oming just at the moment when a jet plane was flying over. So we were getting this combination sound of the roar of a jet engine and Allen Ginsberg chanting. And then as the plane disappeared, it was just him chanting. And oh, man, I thought, oh, gee, I just recorded the best recording in my entire life. And I also, by necessity, had to walk by this building, Rochdale, every once in a while. And one day when I was walking by, I noticed something maybe 100 feet up in the air that was floating along on the wind currents. And it was like it was floating towards me. And so I stopped to look at it, and it eventually fell right at my feet, and it was a men's psychedelic tie. which I still have, by the way, as a proof of this story. Yeah. And I was going like, look, it's a gift from the gods. And I used to wear it all the time, but not much anymore. But eventually, the University of Toronto realized they had made a big mistake. I think it happened when two people got into a fight on the 17th floor and crashed through a window and fell to their death. Mm. And that kind of woke them up, and I think they decided it was a bad idea. But yeah. It was one of those stops along the way. Also, in Toronto, by the way, I was there for a year. It was almost impossible to buy pot. You could buy hash, and you could buy big chunks of hash in their original bags where they're stamped with an Afghani seal and all that kind of stuff. But late in the, I guess it was probably early 1971, my brother, who also lived in Toronto, was able to score a kilo of the best pot that I've ever smoked. Let's see, El Ropo, we called it. And this stuff was pretty much like what I now know is Keef. And I'll get into this a little bit more. Basically, when I started growing my own here in Colorado, I had to learn all the little details. Like, for example, when do you harvest the stuff? Well, when it starts to flower, and the flowers, which are called colas, K-O-L-A, they are like miniature Christmas trees, maybe as big as 10, 12 inches high, just crammed with flowers. You wouldn't call it a flower if you were going to pick it and put it on your table for its beauty. Some of them are purple and green, white, ugly, little twisted little things. But with a magnifying glass, you can actually see the little tiny glands which contain the THC. Hmm. I'm trying to think of the name, which escapes me at the moment, but trichromes. These little trichromes are just like a 32nd of an inch high, and they are on the surface of the leaves near the cola, near the flower. Little short little leaves come out, and they're different from the so-called fan leaves, the bigger leaves at the base of the plant. And once these little trichromes start to appear, whoa, all kinds of things start to happen. First of all, they start to smell. They have a very distinctive turpentine-like odor. And they're even...
I think I probably need to cut in here.
Because I'm going long.
Yeah, you're going long, and you're going long and lovingly into marijuana cultivation.
Yeah,
but I'm not sure all of our listeners will be cool with that. So, what are some highlights that you were really hoping to touch on in this conversation? For example, you mentioned somebody by the name of Mason Tvert.
Yeah.
Who started the pot revolution in Colorado. Maybe that's an important touchstone.
Yeah, the first actual legislation that was passed here had to do with instructions to the Denver Police Department that pot should be the lowest priority. They shouldn't be busting people for pot with the regularity that they were doing it. And so we passed an ordinance saying, just make this the lowest priority. And, of course, the police ignored that ordinance and continued to arrest people. Mason gathered the statistics and then presented them at a hearing that I went to. Now, Mason himself, and he's all over the internet, you can look him up, he's kind of an odd character to be leading this revolution. He's rather portly, mild-mannered, short hair, wears a suit and tie almost all the time, and I was taken by the fact that he didn't fit my my previous thoughts about what the revolutionary was going to look like. So after the hearing, I sat down with him and I asked him if I could interview him because I was there with my camera and everything. And he said, sure. And it turns out the recording was not that good and I never actually published it, but I did hear him tell his story, which was, and I'll try to keep it short here. He was a senior in college, and I can't remember where, but getting ready to graduate. I mean, it was just weeks away when he was busted for smoking pot and denied his bachelor's degree. Well, that didn't sit very well with Mason. So, like most of us, you know, plotting the revenge, we're going to get them. We're going to do something about this. Mason actually did. He devoted his life to this cause and succeeded in, like I said, getting this first ordinance, lowest priority, passed. That was completely ignored. Then his next move, and by the way, this was done in conjunction with Normal and various national organizations, but mostly spearheaded by Mason and his local people, was Amendment 20. And Colorado has this weird system where, you know, the city council can create an ordinance or the citizens can create an ordinance. But if we really want something to stick, what we do is we amend the Constitution. So this particular constitutional amendment was called Amendment 20, and it provided a legal right to smoke marijuana as a medical patient. And it set up the mechanism for doing this with a doctor's approval and blah, 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 through the whole thing. And then you could go to a dispensary to fill your prescription. It wasn't really a prescription, but it was a doctor's recommendation. And you could then buy your medical marijuana if you could show that you had a red card. A red card was issued by the state of Colorado, and it's this clumsy thing that you have to fold into a third, but you can carry it in your wallet. And that proves that you're legal. Go in there and spend a couple $100 buying a particular strain. Under the advice of the caregiver, that was another part of this deal, the caregiver would say, well, what's your medical condition? And you would go like, well, I have persistent back pain, which, by the way, I do, and it's called degenerative disc disease. All organisms that have a spine have this disease, by the way. Basically, what it means is that the discs in between your vertebrae over time and age will slowly degenerate.
Yeah, so you're aging. Now, I think we have what you've described so far here in California, that people can get a medical marijuana card.
Yeah.
It's very easy to get their billboards of doctors advertising.
Yes.
You know, come in and, you know, you'll be interviewed for some cursory period of time, and then you get this card, and then you are allowed to go to a dispensary. But a number of dispensaries have been cracked down upon and
closed. The successful ones, by the way, the big ones have been shut down. The little ones are still allowed to operate.
Yeah, so how is it different? Would you say that Colorado is the leader in terms of legalization and openness about marijuana, and if so, what's different there than here?
Okay, a good question. Amendment 20 was similar to what was going on in California, but it wasn't until Amendment 64 that the progress really started. And Amendment 64 was it was called legalization, but it said it should be regulated like alcohol. So it was kind of a return to sanity. Well, let's allow this stuff for, quote, recreational use, but let's treat it like alcohol. Let's tax it. Let's not sell it to minors. Let's only sell it at approved places, and so on and so forth. And this was just the last election, and it...
How long has that been in operation?
I'm wrong. It was a year before last where a Amendment 64 was approved. In the last election, we had to decide on the tax. And that was a sticky question because the anti-pot people, now admitting that pot was legal in Colorado, adopted a let's tax the hell out of it stance. And, oh man, city council in Denver for the local tax, taxing at every level. How much money can we squeeze out of these potheads now that they're having their way? And the answer was, it ended up being in Denver, about a 45% tax.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not like alcohol at all.
That's a lot more than alcohol and cigarettes?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Way more. And it's taxed at the wholesale level with an excise tax. They have different names for all these taxes. Then at the state level, there's another tax. Then at the city level, there's a tax. Individual communities, townships and so on can prohibit it and have no sales in their county or town. And quite a few have done that at first. We don't want any parts of that pot stuff. Get out of here. However, now that the potential revenues are lining up, and by the way, this goes into effect January 1st, 2014. So at this moment...
This being what? The taxation, the actual collection of funds?
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's when it will start. Yeah, that's
yeah,
when it will
start. Okay. So there's no track record yet. The thing that... that seems problematic to me as I do think it makes sense to tax it, but you don't want to tax so high as to continue to support an underground black market, which is where all the crime comes in.
Right. Yes, that has been pointed out repeatedly by a lot of the more level-headed people that perhaps basically, you know, what it means is let's see now, what were they saying? If you're going in to buy a $200 ounce, you're going to pay about $50 in taxes.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite a bit. But maybe not enough to make you go back to your local street dealer. I don't know. Time will tell. Yeah. And, of course, these taxes can be adjusted up and down. So if it doesn't work... they will adjust the taxes, I'm sure. And by the way, it's going to turn out, at least my prediction is that it's going to bring in multiple millions of dollars. They started getting squirrely with some of the rules. For example, a Colorado resident can buy an ounce, but a visitor can only buy a quarter of an ounce. Of course, you can once it becomes recreational use, as they call it, becomes legal January 1st, you'll be able to go to as many pot stores every day as you want to buy your ounce. So, and the same is true of the visitor. He'll be able to because the former mayor Hickenlooper. And now Governor Hickenlooper.
Did you make up that name?
No, that's his name. That's his real name. People have made up a lot of other variations on
I'll bet.
Chicken Looper, for example. But he's the one that drank fracking fluid. to prove how safe it was.
Oh.
Because he's an oil and gas guy. At any rate, he was very much against this, and he said he didn't want Colorado to become the marijuana state. But guess what? It already is, and it's going to bring in millions of dollars in tourism. There's already, just like wine tours in Sonoma County.
Yeah.
Well, now there are pot tours where you can actually visit Denver, stay in a hotel, and go from dispensary to grow facility to testing lab. And there are so many people interested in this that it's a huge industry already, even before January 1st.
That's amazing. And boy, I'm really going to be interested to track this because, you know, it's got potentially major social implications, economic implications, political implications, medical implications.
Oh, my God, yeah. It's going to be a small revolution. In the medical part alone, already there have been tens of studies coming out showing how even smoking, which is admittedly probably not too good for your lungs, actually smoking pot ameliorates the effects of smoking tobacco.
Hmm.
So if you smoke both, you're better off. shouldn't smoke tobacco. But
you know what? We're at a place where we need to kind of wind down here, but I will definitely want to follow up with you in a year or so on this particular topic just to see how it's unfolded and what the impact has been, and of course, keeping in mind the psychological and social kind of impact.
Can I tell one last story?
You may.
Oh,
it depends upon how long.
Dr. Dave, thank you. I know what you're saying, and I have to tell you, I have listened to every single one of your podcasts over the years, and I love them. I especially loved the one with your son, Jonathan. That was, that was great.
Yeah,
and many of them are just fantastic. And I know you have this concern of going long, but I have to tell you, as an avid listener, I don't care how long they are. It could be 2 hours long. I would love it. But anyway, yeah. I digress. This past year, I made a decision to grow my legal 6 plants in my backyard. Now, my backyard is enclosed in the law, in the amendment, it says can be grown by an individual 6 plants in a, quote, enclosed, locked, unquote, space. Enclosed, locked. Some people have said, well, that means you can't grow it in your backyard because it's not enclosed. But what if you have a 6-foot fence? And it's not visible to the public, and so on and so forth. Well, I was willing to take the chance. So I went out and bought my 6 clones. These are not seeds. These are little 10-inch tall plants cloned off of a mother plant for $10 a piece and put them in my vegetable garden. Planted them far enough apart, I thought, and I was off and running. Well, it was amazing. I developed a relationship with these little plants over the 2 months that they grew. And I would go out and I would sit next to them. And I would smoke a little weed and they were 6 different strains and I was marvel at how they were different from each other. What they're selling now is mostly hybrid, a combination of sativa and indica. Indica is more of a zonk. Sativa is more of an energizer. And so those are the two qualities that stoners are looking for. If you smoke indica, you will go to sleep. It doesn't matter.
Wow.
Forget your Ambien. just get some sativa. Anyway, so I'm growing my plants. I'm grooving on them every day in the brilliant Colorado sunshine. They're growing and growing, and suddenly they're growing too tall for my 6-foot fence.
Uh-oh.
So I'm taking photographs from out in the alley to see if anybody could see. People can see those. So now I'm cutting the tops off of them. They're growing anyway. They're just shooting up. And I have a drip watering system for the first time, and that was a big help. So anyway, I'm going like, oh, wow. They start to emit the odor. And now I know I'm about 2 weeks away from harvest. Unfortunately, a new neighbor moved in next door to me, and they have a third story perch from which they can look directly into my backyard. Well, within an hour of this woman's arrival on the scene, she's over pounding on my door demanding that I get rid of my marijuana garden. I'm going like, well, gee, I know that they smell. I hate the smell. It gets up in my face. And I'm going like, well, yeah, that's what smells do. And I said, I was trying to be reasonable. And I said, you know, the value that we approach, attribute to smells is learned. I said, you know, for example, if a person that you loves is all sweaty, you actually like that smell. And she was going like, yeah, I know what you mean. So little by little, I was winning her over. Unfortunately, the moving crew, five guys, was very interested in not only me, but my pot garden, because they were 5 feet in the back of this truck. They could see my big, giant plants. And they were going back and forth, listening to my conversation with the neighbor, who I think I finally convinced to just give me 2 more weeks and I would be gone. But one of the mover guys from the crew said, he stopped and he said, excuse me for butting into your business, but he said, I used to work at a grow facility and you got to tighten up your act. And I was going like, oh, the voice of doom. So I went back that day and I thought, okay, I'll put up black plastic around the top of my fence to further prohibit people from looking in. Well, that just made it look like I had something to hide.
You know? Right.
And I have
I got a small safe to put some stuff in. I don't have a bunch of money or anything, but I've got a pocket knife collection and my passport and stuff like that. And now I'm worried that if anybody ever breaks into my house, they're going to see that safe and they're just going to tear everything apart to get inside it. But I digress. Go ahead.
Well, the only saving grace of a safe has to be heavy enough that you can't carry it off, right, or bolt it into the concrete. But at any rate, that was on a Thursday that this all took place. And then Sunday night, somebody pulled a pickup truck into my neighbor's yard, climbed over the top, and coming prepared with giant shears to cut through this these trunks of these plants, which were probably 3 inches in diameter. They were huge. Successfully cut off all 6 plants and took them away.
Wow.
I never realized that I would have I would grieve. I was grieving over the loss of these plants.
Sure. And well, a lot of your time and energy went into it. And plus my expectation of.
Yeah, and my relationship to these, I called them my little girls because they're all females, you know, and they have different strain names, you know, Arctic Ice and, I was grieving. Even the more so when I discovered that the state was valuing each of these plants at $2,000. So basically, my $12,000 summer crop was ripped off.
Oh, wow.
And I had a whole new understanding of the lengths to which people will go to get this stuff. And in fact, there were 6 break-ins to grow facilities around that same time. I contacted the police, and they said they weren't interested in pursuing it, so I let it drop. But that's one of the dangers that people are not talking about too much.
Yeah, well, it's amazing. It's amazing that you live in a state where you can go to the police to say my marijuana was ripped off.
I did that with some trepidation.
I would think so, but you did it. You know, I hate to break it off, but we'll just have to keep this conversation going from time to time. We'll see what kind of audience reaction we get here.
Yeah, and by the way, Uruguay, and there's another European, also a European country that has legalized pot. It's sweeping the world. Mm-hmm. This is not, it's going to be like gay marriage. It's going to sweep across all the boundaries, and it may take many years, but eventually it'll happen.
Well, this brings us back to our opening statement where plants are controlling us and marijuana is making us legalize it.
There you go. I think okay. So, Dave. Okay. Really good talking with you, my friend.
Always, always. Okay, we'll be talking down the line. In some ways, the conversation you've just heard is an intimate discussion between two old friends. And old can be taken in both senses of the word. Jerry and I met at the University of Pennsylvania in our freshman year. He had to drop out of school at the beginning of his sophomore year, as I recall. So it was really on the foundation of that one intensive freshman year of contact that this most long-lasting friendship rests. I thought Jerry was the smartest, most creative, and charismatic guy that I'd ever met. There were so many points of similarity in our backgrounds and interests that we really seemed to be soulmates. After he left the University of Pennsylvania, our lives continued to run on amazingly parallel tracks. His reference to the friend in Ann Arbor who first turned him on to marijuana was me. My own recollection, though, is that it was the other way around. But I know my memory's faulty these days. As I say, this conversation is very much a reminiscence between two old friends, and at least for my part, is not intended as a commercial advocating that people smoke marijuana. I do share with Jerry the opinion that it is less harmful than alcohol, and that adults should have the freedom to make that choice. Like Jerry, I'm also appalled that many are in prison for marijuana crimes. Jerry's a frequent marijuana user himself, as he freely admitted in this interview. I, on the other hand, am not. For me, it was largely a social activity rooted in a certain time and place, and even then, I was not a heavy user. The people who I hang out with these days don't use it anymore, at least not socially. I suspect a few do in the privacy of their bedroom, but I don't know that for sure. It would be easy enough for me to get a medical marijuana card here in California, but I have had no interest in pursuing it. If there were any gathering with friends who are smoking marijuana and they offered me some, I would most probably join in. Any hesitation on my part would be due to what, for me, are the unpleasant side effects. I enjoy the initial high and the laughter and humor that it tends to evoke in me. But then later, on the backside, I'm vulnerable to depression as well as an intensified awareness of all my bodily aches and pains. My observation is that individuals have very different experiences as a result of marijuana intake. Each of our bodies is so unique that our reactions to biochemical substances are very individual as well. This is true for all of the drugs that we take, and I think we have yet to fully understand these processes. In the future, the medications that we take may be highly customized to each person's unique biochemistry so as to have the greatest efficacy. I think Jerry's remarks about the various biochemical components in marijuana are relevant here, and I can't help but wonder if there might be a variety out there that would give me the delightful laughing high without the downside. But I'm afraid that I have enough of the Puritan ethic in me to believe that nothing is free and that the tremendous rush of energy associated with psychedelic drugs are bound to have an energetic cost on the backside. This is not something Jerry and I have discussed, at least not in my memory, and it's too bad I didn't bring it up in this interview. I recommend that you check out Jerry's blog at www.denverdirect.tv. Many of the issues that he explores there have wider relevance beyond the city of Denver. After our interview, Jerry sent me a link to an article on the blog healthland.time.com exploring whether marijuana should be considered addictive or not. The entire link is too long to recite here, but let me share one short paragraph, and I quote, "So the question is, how does marijuana compare to these classically addictive drugs? Estimates vary, but compared with tobacco, which hooks about 20% to 30% of smokers, marijuana is much less addictive, coming in at 9 to 10%. In contrast, 23% to 25% of heroin users get addicted, along with 15% of alcohol users and 15 to 20% of those who use cocaine." Now, this article also makes a distinction between the sort of physical addiction that Jerry spoke about and psychological addiction. Personally, I do believe that some small proportion of people, maybe right around 9 or 10%, as this article suggests, are psychologically vulnerable to becoming addicted. Also, after our interview, Jerry sent me a news story, a breaking news story, about a large crackdown on a number of marijuana shops in Denver on the very day of our interview. The basis for closing them down is not known at present. However, it was reported that there was IRS, that is Internal Revenue Service, involvement. So it might be that they failed to pay the necessary taxes. There are still such strong feelings about marijuana on both sides of the fence, and still so many open questions from both a scientific point of view and a social one, as well as psychological, that I think Colorado is potentially the largest testing ground so far for addressing these issues. And that's why both Jerry and I thought this a worthy topic for Shrink Wrap Radio. And we hope you agree.
Got the Dr. Dave habit? Need a fix? Just follow these three easy steps to your podcast high. Step one, log on to the Shrink Wrap Radio website and click on the big green donate button. Step two, choose the PayPal or credit card option. Step three, click on the contribution amount that best suits your level of need, like Ultra Colossal at $35 a month. If you're really strung out and download each new episode the minute it's posted and then listen to it several times. Super Colossal at $30 a month if you've got a serious Shrink Wrap Jones. Jumbo at $10 a month if you're a recreational listener. Large at $5 if you're in denial and think you can quit listening at any time. Or Generous if you know you're not hooked and just enjoy expanding your mind. Ah, now doesn't that feel better? I thank you, and Dr. Dave thanks you.
And thank you, Sister Sherry. Wow, it's kind of synchronistic that I grabbed this particular donation request, given that it's all about getting high and our interview is about marijuana. Actually, my son Jonathan and I just got back a few days ago from a four-day visit with my sister, Sherry, and her husband, Mike, down in Baja California, Mexico. It had been some years since we had seen them, and we had a beautiful visit. By the way, a number of listeners wrote in to say how much they enjoyed the interview with Jungian analyst Dr. James Hollis. Well, our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, is hosting a four-week live teleseminar course with him. You can either attend in person in Salt Lake City or online. For full details, you should go to www.jungplatform.com and click on Upcoming Events. I'm not sure if it will ask if you have a discount code, but if it does, please enter Dr. Dave, that's D-R-D-A-V-E. In other news, I was recently interviewed by Brett Bernhoft of the Bipolarness Podcast, which you can find at www.bipolarness.com. In case you're not aware of it, we have an app for both iOS and Android devices. Just click on the Apps tab on our site for full details. And if you're new to Shrink Wrap Radio, you might not be aware that if you are a professional in need of continuing education units, we have about 99 APA-approved units that you can earn for listening to these interviews and passing a brief true-false quiz on the material, all for less than $10 a unit. And with that, I think we will wrap up this section for today. Now let's hear some recent emails from our listener community. Actually, because we're running long, I'm only going to take time to read one. It's fairly long, but also very important. It comes from Tamara, who is a local marriage and family therapist in my area, but whom I've never met in person, as far as I know. And she writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I've been listening for 3 years through my marriage family therapist internship process and thankfully into licensure. I love your show and promote it to my fellow interns and friends." And as an aside here, I say thank you for that, Tamara. She goes on to say, "I didn't need to know what this show was about to know I was going to like it. You are clearly a skilled and innovative man to bring forth Shrink Wrap Radio, and I was immediately curious to meet your son, Jonathan. Of course, hearing the interview, I was completely blown away and inspired. I was reminded by Jonathan and the other nurses what I value about life, charity, courage, community, and commitment, things that, in my opinion, rarely make the news, at least not often enough. Something else, however, happened during that interview, and that something is why I am writing. By the end of the show, I realized that the nurses were actually trying to set the record straight and reminding people what they do, and that in our culture, these, quote, soft skills are undervalued until a time of dire need, in which case they can make a huge difference, and that nurses are constantly handling crises on a daily basis, which is very different from the general public who are not looking after cancer patients or HIV patients. As I listened, I realized that as a young therapist, that is what I also do. And sadly, in the past 5 years of working as an intern, never mind the 3 years of education and student loans, I've been paid close to nothing. And I wanted to write to you about this feeling because, well, a lot of reasons. First of all, the nature of this show has inspired me so many times because I love the work you do and because there are so many other marriage family therapists and PsyD and PhD interns in the field of psychology who, like myself and like nurses, are largely unsung heroes in this American culture and likely elsewhere too. During my 5 years of interning, I have initiated 5150s for minors. That's threat of harm to self. I've called Child Protective Services numerous times. I've been involved in court cases. I've worked with clients who are mandated by the courts to receive counseling prior to returning for mediation. And I've worried why clients have stopped coming. Do I need to send the police for a wellness check? Are they alive or are they all right and just let them be? I have also loved my clients, laughed with them, and have witnessed them getting better, which is why I love my job. But I have done all of this essentially for free. Most of us interns either have a savings account, a second job, or a loving partner behind the scenes who makes this work possible for the first decade. I say all this just to bring awareness to the fact that many of us are working without health insurance, without the ability to put money in our savings accounts, without being able to buy a new car, own a home, or anything remotely close to the things that many people do in their lifetime while working. Unlike nurses who can go out and get a job, and I'm aware that there have been a greater supply of nurses than jobs, and that is very difficult, I believe 80% of marriage family therapists and psychologists go into private practice. Let me state what was not clear to me. Every one of us who does not get hired will become business entrepreneurs, spend our last dimes marketing and trying for 2 to 5 years after we've interned to turn ourselves into business owners, for which many of us have never had a single class. Eventually, I do believe things work out. After we've realized that we have to learn a new skill, network well, market, push our student loans back, and take on a second job for a while, many of us do make it. And some of us make it with less stress than others. But some of us don't make it at all. I've had my share of friends return to other jobs because the cost of becoming a therapist or psychologist was simply too high. Finally, I would just mention that even CAMFT, which is the local California Association of Marriage and Family Therapists, has mixed messages that it sends its pre-licensed to recently licensed group. While there is often a lot of exciting things happening in the licensed world, I've come across several business documents asking the question, "Are you sure you want to go into private practice?" Those documents go on to ask if we really want to incur the costs and hardship of sole proprietorship. The problem is this. We've already invested a huge amount into school. We've already interned and are interning. And frankly, there simply aren't that many marriage family therapists paid job positions with agencies and hospitals to support us all. Furthermore, most of those paid positions are more geared toward case management than actual psychotherapy, which is technically a skill set marriage family therapists have, but most of us have been gearing up to do one-on-one work. So I feel like our own association warns us against our own profession rather than spend more time really helping us feel hopeful and excited. And so thankfully, what this field lacks in money, we make up for in good people and really interesting work. I don't know if I could have made it without my funny, talented, caring, and witty colleagues and supervisors, and finally, my loving and supportive husband. I believe, much like a number of your listeners, that this work is invaluable. I believe there are creative geniuses working on innovative ways of getting the message out there. Instead of being devalued for 5 to 10 years, I wonder how we can build a field that supports its young therapists better, educational faculties that teach business and marketing alongside couples counseling, campaigns that promote a school counselor in every school, and a belief that we should really institute a workforce of therapists into our communities to help promote mental wellness, better communication, better treatment of minors, less loneliness, and maybe, like Bhutan, we can start talking about America's own gross national happiness. How else to eliminate gun violence, drop suicide rates, promote healthy families, alleviate depression in the elderly? I think solid leadership and PR work in this field could make a huge difference. Anyhow, Dr. Dave, I know this is a long email, and you're free to read it out loud or just reflect on it yourself. I just could not let the opportunity pass without speaking to the challenges of being in this field. And while I've been told countless times everyone pays their dues, I'm telling you, I haven't seen a single other professional field have to pay this high of a price. If we're going to be on the hook for 10 years of our adult lives, I'd like to see a lot of reform and support geared to a positive image of what is possible for us all and how we can influence local and national policy to encourage greater monetary support for mental health and to start taking these fields more seriously and work on PR that promotes this image in the mainstream media. Thanks, Dr. Dave, and keep up the good work. I'm so glad you're out there. Warmly. And that's from Tamara Green, MA, MFT, Santa Rosa, California. And Tamara, I just had to read out your name, your full name. Hope I won't get you into trouble, but I'm so impressed by this passionate letter that you've written me that you deserve credit. And in fact, I wrote back to Tamara and suggested that she should try to find someplace to have this published as a letter to the editor, perhaps in a journal, even in the local newspaper, except they don't publish such long letters to the editor. I think this could be turned into an article It should be turned into an article that may help advance your career as well. Partly, I think some of the problem lies with the educational institutions that are turning out MAs, marriage, family, and therapists. There may be an oversupply of not only marriage and family therapists, but also psychologists. And so it behooves the professional associations to monitor the market and to let hopeful students know what awaits them to make sure that they really are up to the challenge. Well, I could go on and on as well, but I don't think I will. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio. Remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-350-9918. Thanks to today's guest, my old friend Jerry Trumbull, for sharing developments in the Great Colorado Cannabis Experiment. On the next episode, I'll be speaking again with Dr. John C. Robinson, whom you will recall was my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio number 354, in which we spoke about his book, What Aging Men Want. In the next episode, we'll be talking about his book, The Three Secrets of Aging. It promises to be deep and evocative. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.